This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
Okay. Good morning, friends online too. As I said, I thought we were going to have maybe 8 or 10 people there this morning. I had imagined and created this whole little scene where we were going to actually know each other's names. But now there's a lot of us, and it might be a little bit more challenging. I know and recognize many of you. It's wonderful to have you here at Jikoji, and welcome back. And some of you are new faces, and we're very happy to have you here. I always like to start by acknowledging that we are actually resting. Jikoji is on the unceded land of the Ohlone people, the native people to this region, who have lived in the Bay Area for over 10,000 years. And we recognize them, their history, their culture. And we kind of hope that our recognition, our acknowledgement, conveys goodwill to the Ohlone and their descendants who are among us. And even zooming out farther, we hope that our acknowledgement and recognition of the Ohlone people allows us to recognize all people, all cultures, and our incredibly vast, interconnected, shared existence. In my last two talks here, which have been separated by several weeks, we talked about one of the foundational teachings of the Buddha, the three marks of existence. I've covered two marks, which were impermanence and suffering. And so this week I'd like to address the third mark of existence, not self. People think not self is something other than not self is, which is really interesting. They think they have to somehow completely evaporate as beings. So I think we will maybe explain that a little bit today, or at least explore it together. This particular teaching is the Buddha's second teaching. So right after his awakening, I'll teach a little bit more about his awakening in a second, but right after his awakening, there was this 49-day period where he wasn't teaching, but then he taught. And this is the second of his teachings. And so it's very important and very foundational. So as I mentioned, the three marks of existence, sorry. Are impermanence. I imagine you had a taste of impermanence this morning in your meditation. Did you notice some thoughts and feelings and sensations coming and going? Impermanence, a very easy, accessible way to notice the embodiment of impermanence. Of course, that's going on at many levels all the time. That's a taste of impermanence. And suffering, or dukkha, or dissatisfaction, or dis-ease, is when we try to hold on to those things that are impermanent. One way or another, we try to cling to them, either because we want more or we want less. That's like, you know, a thimbleful of suffering. If you want to learn more about these things, you can watch our YouTube video where Taishin has been posting things, thankfully. So today I want to talk about this third mark, non-self. So I mentioned after his awakening, the Buddha didn't teach for 49 days, which for those of you who are familiar with the Bardo, 49 days there too. But the thing that's important about this is that he thought he could not teach, that he would not be able to convey his insights, that people would not be willing to receive his understanding. Why? Why would he think that? I have a pet theory that I don't think is a big reach. My background is in evolutionary biology. That's my undergraduate degree. And I think that the Buddha was saying that everything about us, so this is my bias, okay, I have a bias. But I think the Buddha may have been saying that everything about being a human being is designed to have us actually individuate in a very particular way to actually have a self that is separate and distinct. His teaching, which we'll go to in a minute about non-self, kind of goes against the stream of ego and all of our human desires to be somebody, to seek control and to have an identity. Goes against the stream of our habit. Goes against the stream, I think, of our very biology, whether it's through having children or any other immortality project, which could be your career. So at a basic level, I think that humans are shaped to, this is my partner, Michael, making some indication to me that I don't understand. Okay. This is how you live with him all the time. He's making indications I don't understand. Why don't you unmute and say what you want to say, Shoho?
Identity, identity. Okay. Identity. Look at me. Look at me.
Very subtle. Yeah. Okay. And mute yourself again, honey.
Okay.
So, at a very basic level, I think all humans are kind of designed to be seen as individuals and identify ourselves as special. And then protect these selves and defend these selves and assert these selves and impose these selves to carry this life forward, to maintain some kind of continuity and to kind of solidify an identity. So this is maybe a not so unconscious desire for immortality, but everything in us wants to say, this I must continue. And I think what the Buddha realized, and thankfully ended up teaching, and what you too, what all of us can also realize, is something very radically different. And that is, there is no fixed self. There is no stable, continuing self that we have to and defend. No self to advance, actually. No solid someone who is at the center of each experience. And this is the third mark of existence, non-self. Now, when I say this, maybe you have a little sense of existential anxiety about that I'm somehow erasing you, or negating you. But that is not what not self is. I mean, I feel pretty real to me, and you look pretty real to me. And I'm pretty sure you're feeling pretty real. But in my experience, my own experience, and maybe yours too, the real embodied awareness of not self is not existentially anxiety making. It is actually liberating. And this is what the Buddha thought and thought maybe no one would really understand. In my own experience, it's a huge relief. So sometimes a personal story is illustrative of some of the things we want to share. And so I'm going to share a story from many, many years ago in a galaxy far, far away. In my own life, in a temple a long time ago, some distance away, I was serving as Jisha, like Patima did for me this morning, for my teacher, Taishin's teacher as well. And it was a Sunday morning just like this in Santa Barbara. And we chanted the Jewel Mirror Sutra, the Song of the Jewel Mirror Awareness. Happens to be one of my favorites. But, you know, I would just chant and chant and chant. You know, I didn't actually have any meaning associated with this chant, but I really liked it. And somehow that morning, I sat down on the seat. My teacher was on the chair after he finished chanting. There we did the service first and then meditated. And the minute the bell rang, I had this really very clear awareness, insight. I don't want to make it sound anything too special because I think it's just the way things are. But in that moment, it felt like, oh my gosh, kind of like, I get it. And what I got, hey, Peterson. These are dear friends in Chicago. What I got was this very sudden, clear understanding that Zazen, this practice, is the jewel mirror. And what that meant is my actual experience was, oh, I see myself in this mirror of Zazen. I see this person. Well, I also see this person and all the other people in the Zendo. I saw them all. And then I saw everything in the Zendo, the room itself, and then the building itself, and then Santa Barbara. And it just kept zooming out. The whole world from the beginning of time was in the mirror of Zazen. And the thing that was really interesting about this experience is that nothing was in the mirror. Everything, the mirror was empty, and everything was in the mirror, but there was nothing in the mirror. And I don't want to sound all Zen because, you know, I'm not pretending here. I'm explaining my own experience. But what was really happening is that I could see that nothing was staying the same. I could see impermanence right there. Including this one, nothing essential and stable and continuing in the mirror of Zazen. It wasn't standing still. There is no fixed someone having the experience of what was in the mirror. There is no one and no thing in the mirror. And for some reason, this was not at all troubling. But a huge relief, like as if I had spent my entire life carrying around this scaffolding. Does everyone know what a scaffolding? It's like those structures that they put around buildings to kind of secure them as they're building more building. It's like I had been carrying around this scaffolding around my body. This body and mind had this scaffolding that I had been carrying around, and it was not comfortable. At some level, I wasn't comfortable. Carrying around the scaffolding everywhere I went to protect something inside the scaffolding. And I put it down. I didn't say I put it down. It fell off. It just was gone because it wasn't there anymore. It was so clear it wasn't there. And yet nobody was missing. Even though nothing was in the mirror, nobody was missing. Everybody was with me. All of you were with me, even though we hadn't been met. And the Buddhist language for this is dependent origination, this shared existence, this endless interconnection. The traditional way of expressing this exists because this exists, and that happens because that happens. So for an easy example of this right here and now, you can look at the trees outside because Jikoji is so blessed with all these trees. And you know that they depend on air and soil and water. Just like our thoughts depend on memory and mood, chemistry, conditions. So each moment, moment after moment after moment, depends on everything that came before and is somehow inextricably linked to everything that's coming next. When the Buddha sat down to face himself, life, Just as we sit down to meet ourselves, life as it is. He looked very closely to see if he could find a self. And he couldn't. And we cannot. We do not. What we find is relationships, which some of you are probably tired of hearing me talk about, because I've been talking about relationships for many years. But for me, that's all there is relationship. I cannot find a way around that. All there is relationship. And this is, of course, the third mark of existence, not self, not a separate self. So the understanding that the Buddha wanted to convey about not self is kind of set forth quite lovingly, I think, in a conversation he had with Ananda, a monk, Ananda, who happened to be his cousin, to whom we owe a lot, by the way. If you don't know Ananda, bow to Ananda. He's a good guy. And this conversation is often referred to as empty is the world. And I really like this one because Ananda asks the Buddha why the Buddha said the world is empty. And the Buddha answers, the world is empty because it is empty of a self. And anything that could be considered a self, anything that belongs to a self, everything is empty of any fixed, independent identity. So this is not self. We exist in relationship right now and all the time to everything. The Buddha then specified what we really are, and what we really are is like a river of different streams coming together inside each of us and all together. And we chanted them this morning. We are a river of these things. I'm going to tell you what they are in a sec. Unless you know them, anybody want to tell me? Not you. I know he knows them. These are the skandhas. So the Buddha said that what we actually are these converging streams, a river of, as we chanted this morning, form, feeling, sensation, impulse, consciousness. Sometimes impulse is translated as mental formations. So the river of form, and that form is this physical aspect of our existence, our bodies and our sense organs. The river of feeling is the sensations that arise in response to our sense organs, including all pain and pleasure, which is either negative, positive, or neutral, or pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral is how the language usually is. Not negative, that's a whole nother layer. And then there's the river of perception, which is the intellectual process of recognizing and then identifying and separating and then interpreting that information. And then there's the river of mental formations, which are thoughts and emotions, our biases, our habit activities, the things we keep doing over and over again. And then there's the river of consciousness, which is the subjective understanding of those other skandhas. So that is what we are. These rivers are always flowing through us, through us individually, through us collectively, and nothing is fixed. Obviously, it's a river. They don't hold still. Nothing is fixed and permanent, and none of it exists separately. So in the inseparability of all those streams, and the impermanence of all of those experiences, is the fullness of our experience of this shared life. So yes, in the emptiness is the fullness. And here I am sounding all zenny again. But that's the way it is. The Fullness comes from our interconnection. So if everything exists in this interconnected space of relationship, what do we do about this self that we have to feel sometimes is centered here and we're carrying around like that scaffolding? That self that we feel we have to promote and defend. The sense of a solid me who is owning this experience, by the way. The Buddha taught that that idea of a me is a construct, a fabrication, which occurs, it kind of appears when we don't look closely. When he looked closely, no self that is stable. And you may have noticed this morning in your meditation again. How many of you think that you were in charge of the thoughts? I hope you had some thoughts. If not, I'm going to have to come take your pulse. But I hope you had this experience of noticing these thoughts. And maybe, well, just tell me, how many of you think that you were directing the thoughts, that you were deciding what was coming up, what when they were coming up, like the timing, and how they were going to affect you? Anybody? Right. No. They come. And they go if you don't grab them. And they go. A thought comes, hangs around for a moment. Off. Next thought comes, hangs around for a moment. Off. They just appear. So what we call this self is like that. It is a process. I am Nenzenning right now. Wei is weighing right now. We're all just inging right now. This room is inging right now. The world is inging right now. Sounds a little awkward, so you can use your regular name as you go. You don't go, oh, I'm inging. But you know this because the person you were 10 years ago is not this person right now. Maybe even not the person you were this morning. So even though we go through our lives saying me and myself and mine, we kind of assume ownership of this thing. There is ample reason to doubt that assumption of ownership. For another example that came out of your Zazen this morning, maybe you heard some turkeys. Maybe you heard the motorcycles on Skyline. Maybe you heard the scrub jays. And there's this moment when you heard that sound and there was no hearer. There is just the sound. And then you identified the sound. And maybe you had an opinion about the sound next. The mind just rushes in right after something's been experienced, which is just sound. At that point, just sound, there's no inside and outside. There's that moment, you know it, where it's just the sound. But then the mind rushes in and identifies it and categorizes it and then puts it into pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. Maybe you're thinking, Jikoji should do something about those turkeys. They're really interfering with my concentration. Or those motorcycles, or those scrub jays. Right there, when you identify it, an identity in you, someone is appearing. Before that, there's no someone having this experience. It's just the experience. And the same is true of your thoughts. You know that. There's a thought coming through as you're sitting in Zazen. But before you start taking it apart, and some of us are trained to do this, to be very analytical, before you start identifying it, labeling it, and calling it mine, there's just a thought. Same with your feelings and sensations and impulses and consciousness. Everything. You should doubt the assumption that you own these experiences. When we practice a lot with noticing impermanence, that first mark of existence, through this zazen, through being alive in our own present moment, noticing impermanence, we cannot help but feel relief. Some of the things that arrive phenomenologically are things that when we pick them up and call them ours, not so comfortable. Think of the difference between I'm an angry person, or I'm ego-driven, or I'm impatient, or anybody want to offer one? Some way in which you've limited your definition to this thing? The difference between that and there's anger, there's impatience, there's frustration, there's an ego. Big difference, right? We get used to seeing what arrives in zazen as a phenomenon, just as like weather. My friend Hogan the other day told me, some of you know Hogan, he's really a dear friend, a Dharma brother to all of us. He was teasing me and joking about it. He had heard a teaching that said, it's just what the lunch lady is serving. Some of you don't know what the lunch lady is because I'm old, but it used to be you'd go to school and there'd be a cafeteria and she'd just plop your food on your plate. And that's what the lunch lady was serving. And it's nothing personal. What you're experiencing in any given moment is just what the lunch lady is offering today. Don't take it so personally. It's just what's getting plopped onto your platter. That's what the lunch lady offered. Now, having said all this, I want to reiterate that speaking of not self is not a negation of this existence, all of ours existence. Life is still happening. Breathing is happening. Sitting is happening. Walking is happening. Nenzenning is happening. Shan is happening. We're all happening. We're happening, babe. But there is no fixed, independent controller behind all that activity who's deciding what thoughts are going to come and go in any given moment, who's deciding what feelings and sensations and emotions are going to arrive in any given moment. There's nobody controlling it. No fixed self. Just process. Just relationship. That's all I can find. And why does this matter? What's the big deal about not self? Well, I'm going to go out on a limb and say that most of you are here because of this awareness of the capital S self, that scaffold self that you're carrying around. I mean, for me, I came to practice because I was suffering carrying around that scaffolding. I may not have known it, but I knew I was suffering. It's a burden to have a capital S self. I think most people come to Jikoji because they think maybe the Buddha was onto something. That's onto something. Our suffering, which is the second mark of existence, arises because of this very strong evolutionary imperative to be somebody, to advance that someone and to defend that somebody. And that somebody, that effort to stick out, be seen and acknowledged, is actually the source of our suffering. This self is moving. If we try to grip it, more suffering. Some of you know this because Maybe you've been in situations where you know you should get out, but you stay, you grip, more suffering. So you can maybe now see that these three marks of existence, impermanence, suffering, and not self are also not separate. They are completely intertwined. In our daily lives, we sometimes have these notions of the self. I should be more like this. In my case, I should be more patient. I'm actually really patient with everybody but me, most of the time, someone here might argue. But I should be more patient, or I should be whatever, fill in the blank, whatever you'd like, whatever your form of self harm is. I should be more like that. I should be more like this. And this is not spoken in a way of, bodhicitta or inspiring. It's usually self-punishing. But every time you hear that voice, you are fabricating yourself. It's a very clear, like, ding, ding, ding. You're making up a self. Maybe even during meditation this morning, you thought, I should be calm. I shouldn't have any thoughts. I do not like that itch. All of these things. Or I should be more zen. That should, any one of those shoulds, is this attempt to solidify self. Make a capital S self, somebody. And trust me, it's a lot of work. Whatever is asking to be seen in any part of your experience is an attempt to create a self. Trying to stabilize this moving thing. Now, I don't want you to think that trying to stabilize this self and kind of get grounded in some way in something that you think is really me and permanent is bad or is wrong. I wouldn't say that. But it is a constructed self. And we construct this through mostly through memory and habit and a lot of unconscious material. I personally find it a burden. Your mileage may vary. Maybe you'll enjoy carrying around a scaffolding, but I found it pretty liberating. I find it pretty liberating every time the scaffolding falls away. In my own practice, I think of it this way. You can work with the capital S self two ways. One is self as content, self as content. And with that content comes a story about, oh, well, I'm this way because that happened and I was victimized here and victimized there, or I made these bad choices and I victimized other people. So that self as content is one way. For me, that looks like suffering. You find out for yourself. Another way of dealing with capital S self is self as context. Context. And you probably know what I'm pointing to. Relationship. Self as it arises right here, right now, in relationship. And in that way, that self becomes an observer. I am not angry. There is some anger. That difference is very profound, pretty life-changing when you don't have to identify with everything that pushes your buttons. So, as an observer, dealing with this self as context as opposed to content, we can be the sky, as vast as the sky, or as empty as a mirror, where stuff's coming through, Stuff's just coming through. The sky doesn't have any self-identity or nature. It's just like a container for everything that goes through it. And that's what we are too. So what happens when we loosen the self? We set down the scaffolding. I'm not going to deny that there might be a period where that falls away, and there might be a little like, uh-oh, what's left? You know, like this very profound sense, like, wait a minute, what happened to I? But you may not have that experience. You may just feel, whew, I'm free. This loosening makes life very playful and spontaneous and less self-conscious, wildly less self-conscious, because the self doesn't seem to be anything permanent that you should be self-conscious about. I mean, it's not analytical like that, but it just kind of evaporates, not permanently, trust me. Comes, it goes. The one really profound experience around this falling away of the scaffolding is there's really no one to advance. There's no one that you have to promote anymore. There's no sense that you have anything to prove. That is really a wonderful feeling. For those of you who've already, I mean, I had a career, many of you have careers. There is that kind of pressure to prove yourself, to demonstrate your capacity and your competency, and to kind of almost stick out like our DNA wants us to and say, look at me and recognize my contribution and aren't I special? And when that goes away, it feels really good. You just don't need it. And you're aware that you don't need it. And that is really a delicious place to play. I mean, it is really great. Because you're just responding to what's here all the time without feeling like you have to be, have your contribution recognized. It doesn't have to happen. There's no me that has to be in that role. You get comfortable with whatever the lunch lady is serving at any given time. Now, you could look at me up here, sitting here as a teacher, and say, well, easy for you to say, but I'm just as surprised as you are that I'm sitting up here as a teacher. This was not my plan. This is just what happened. The lunch lady delivered this life. And I said, okay. So when we experience this, not intellectually, not because you read it in a book, not because you heard it from me, but actually through your own bodily experience, the burden of being someone so dramatically feels unimportant that we stop wanting to be anyone. It just doesn't matter. It's like becomes irrelevant. Like the ingredient doesn't exist. We stop having to be anybody or anything than what is actually right here, right now, and whoever she is, who knows, in any given moment by moment experience. And it's interesting because you feel totally and dynamically engaged, but it's not about you. There's no center. It's about this right now, you. And me, and us, and this building, and everything that came before us, that brought us here. Total dynamic functioning, Zenkei, in Japanese. And interestingly, the feeling is, from the inside of that, it's enough. It's enough. You don't really need anything more. It's just enough, because it's so full of so much potential. So much possibility, and not just this part, not just this part. There is a kind of joyful ease. Okay, that's what the lunch lady gave me. I'll take it. I'll eat it. I'll do my best to use that fuel to meet you, to be recognition of you. This moment. So now maybe you have a sense of this not self. It is this meeting all the time, everywhere you go, everything you see, that bird flying. He's slowly, I don't know what's wrong with him. It's a very slow little flap over there. Fact is that this is all happening in relationship all the time. Nothing stands alone. We are never alone. Can't be. So the question becomes not who is this? What is this? What is this? What is this? What is happening right here, right now? Everything is possible there. We have so little time together on this planet. It's incredibly precious to be together, to enjoy our lives. May we take care of our own lives, which means taking care of each other's lives, gently, lovingly, recognizing the empty mirror reflecting everything and everyone. May we actually enjoy this endless interconnection. Your turn. You can ask questions or make comments or people online, you want to go first, Akbar-san. Have to unmute. Well, Akbar's going.
I've
Oh,
unmuted.
well.
Okay,
Okay,
no,
well,
I
your
was
name's
having a
not
problem
Akbar.
unmuting myself. Yes, I'm sorry. Thank you very much for this talk. And I have a visual that helps me to picture
Want to use visual.
this non-self. It's the
That's right.
starling's murmuration.
Oh.
When you see those birds, they're just moving around as a big body, as if something is controlling them, and none of those single birds is in control of anything. It's just the whole thing is moving. And you can scale this as from your neurons to the society, that everyone is moving in some way of, reacting to something. Yeah. So there is no one self in there, no single person or no single bird in charge there. It's just that the whole thing is moving. That's my picture that I try to stick to it and remember.
Akbar, thank you so much. Everyone heard that, yes? What a wonderful vision. I love that too. And yeah, maybe that's the thing that we're so enchanted by when we see them. Well, that's us.
Thank you.
You wanting to speak, Michael?
Yes. Yeah, it was a very good talk. That stuff I forget about, and then you remind me. But you're talking about sense of self and how many selves. And I just went home after a very long absence to where I grew up. And man, did I have a sense of all the selves that I have been. I mean, it was really remarkable, and how fluid it all is from one moment to the next, and how it all changes in an eye blink. It was rather profound, but it really got a sense of this universe of selves, all the selves that I was, all the selves I am, and all the selves that will be. I just got this whole kaleidoscope. It's like looking through one of those kaleidoscopes when you're a kid, you turn them, and it was like, whoa. It was really kind of a little hard to put into words, but it was quite an immense feeling. But thank you for your talk.
Thank you for sharing this. I think it's very important that as practitioners, we understand what Michael's speaking about. Look at all the selves. Look at all the selves we've already been. And then just think of it exponentially. I mean, look at all the selves we are, all of us. And our practice is to radically accept all of those selves, right? Not cut out the ones that we think, oh, I wish I hadn't done that. Because you wouldn't be this without all of those selves. And this is fantastic. Being alive is great, whatever it is. And it is all of those other selves and all of these other selves together. So it's important to go to the next step and realize the richness of this selfing that we're doing and the impermanence of this selfing. Thank you. They show some.
I so appreciate your talk today, and I wanted to recognize that behind you there's a switch plate that has a shadow that creates a great big L, a capital L instead of a capital
Oh.
S. So just to representing love and how we can be free to love when we're not carrying this scaffolding as a burden. And I love that image because that's, I think, what the Buddha and what you're saying is to be present for what is our experience of devoting ourselves to this practice. Thank you.
Yeah, I like to use this word love too. I find it's very triggering for other people. So, but yeah, I think the Buddha was about love, about our connection. And that love, of course, includes everything, including our sense of disconnection and hatred and anger. The love is the whole thing. I like these visuals very much. Thank you. And yeah, it's a relief. A big relief to be able to, even in the midst of discomfort, to be really touching, interconnected. So that when someone is upset with you, you are not having to defend. If someone gives you some feedback that feels yucky, you can think, who is that? I'm a little uncomfortable with it. Or if someone comes at you really looking angry and saying things, you can say, because you're not at the center of the experience. Already that sense. Yeah, that's love. Yeah. In this area, not forgot that there was an area, there's a name. Come back and tell us. Yeah. Yeah, some of you maybe remember being children in the sense of not being separate from experience. Not having an opinion or a sense of being separate from you. I remember this very clearly of, there's no difference between me and the grass and the clouds. Like, not intellectually, not like that. the way I just expressed it. Four words, I guess, is the way I would say it. Before we separate and navigate into the territory where there's grass and clouds and moon, that kind of merging experience with this observer of the experience. Yeah, I think that neuroscience is a really fertile way of looking at Buddhism. For that matter, so is quantum entanglement physics. Everything is kind of proving what the Buddha said 2,500 years ago. Pretty cool, all these different ways of looking at it. Yeah, we have a negativity bias. Yeah, that's about preserving self, right? Protecting self. I gotta watch out because someone could try and take something. Really? What could they possibly take? The money, the clothing. Wish they'd take your identity. I shouldn't joke about that. Where is identity though? That could be a problem. Completely ice cream.
That is my visualization of you.
Thank you for that. Of course, sun is behind you. Now we all we can see with ice cream all over you. Yeah, but you can have this experience without even going outside of into your imagination level. You've got a good one there, this memory. But you know, we talk about mindfulness all the time. And you know, I was washing my coffee cup this morning. This little glimpse of the bubbles and the water and the cup and the sponge. And I was like, oh my God, this is so wonderful. What is so wonderful? It's just that there is nothing else happening at this moment. And so you can just return to this moment like that. And even in the midst of a discomforting moment, great beauty. We've talked about this. They show on a little bit about in the midst of our discomfort, beauty. I know this is true in grief. Great love in grief. And you are washing dishes. You're completely absorbed, as Wavis is describing, completely involved. There's nothing else except for this now, 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 now. And it's great. Maybe we'll all think about your son. Ice cream. Yes. It's a big ask to accept you. This is the Buddha's very first teaching. Suffering requires this is here. He's telling you. Gave myself. I asked my teacher to give me this. He didn't. I took it. I was so pretending.
it means that I be means like liberation. I see it's simply acknowledging there's anger. The other side of all that is love, 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 love. And they exist together. I wouldn't know this without them. It happens because of it's true, and you know, some of us live here. It is continuous practice. Not in a there's no avoiding yourself. You're running into yourself all the time. So yeah, and when you go out in the world, you run into yourself. It's delightful. And also requires you to pay. That's what can be. Attention to what's arising. Because it's not you. You, it's the self. Yes. Isn't something we're doing when we're just living here. Every single heartbeat and breath. So everyone is doing it. Helping and letting go. One more. Yeah. Maybe tomorrow. No idea, and nor do you, and nor can we. To have the answer to that would be to understand the history of the entire universe. I know how you got here. You drove up the hill, and I drove up the hill. But that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about what calls you to come up here and sit here and face yourself. It's all of us. Melt into this shared. Do it all for you. I used to think that there would be a way. I'm trained as a lawyer, and lawyers do this thing where they basically take the structures apart until they get to them. And this, Your Honor, is the cause of all of this. There's no doing that. It didn't exist in law either. I am recovering. But
There is this kind of incredible selfing desire to get to the bottom of this and pull out of the ball of yarn the one little thread and say, ta-da! There's just no way. I'm just so grateful you're here, but I have no way of saying it. And really, it was unpredictable from any, well, maybe not. One of my friends from law school was coming up and, well, obviously you're always a Buddhist monk. And I absolutely would never have said that about you. So maybe it was visible to other people, and maybe it's visible to me that you should be here, but not you. And it doesn't matter. I don't know what that is. In the tradition, you know, there's this bodhicitta, this desire to be awake that drives people to practice. I'm not going to deny that because I experienced that. Like, for me, it was probably tied in a little bit to, I don't know, the bottom of this. But I did get to the bottom, and it was the ground. That's the same ground we're all on. So I don't have any ideas, I don't, about being able to do what you're proposing. But maybe you will. Maybe we can come back. Because I don't have the corner on the library. And I would like to know if someone else has an idea that is not selfing about how we got here. Roxy, I saw one. I think you're going to be the last person. Remember how we were talking about sound, sitting in meditation? And then there's the identification of the sound. And then there's maybe a story about how I don't like that sound or I do like that. Before any of that extra stuff happens, advocate, just the sound, just an observer observing, experiencing, not separate from the observer. They're happening in relationship. If you wake up in the morning in a woman's body and think this is a woman's body, you can think that, but it is just the body. So this putting language to these things. Really difficult. Even all these words really aren't touching experience. They're just an approximation. It's what we have. Helped. Buddha said. Helpful. But I would say you tell yourself the truth about what is here. What is here? It doesn't have gender. I mean, but to say it's non-binary is now another level. When people, you know, I'll tell you the truth that I was a woman in a law firm with all men. At this, in Buddhism, I was the only woman I knew in Buddhism for a long time, for some time, who was a priest. I actually formed a group called Vows, the Voices of Women in Zen, because I wanted to talk to other women. And I'd like, hi, I know you're a woman. Can we talk? And it wasn't because what I really wanted to get at is I didn't want to be viewed as a woman. I just wanted to be viewed as a being, like you're a being and you're a being. I just didn't like the imposition of gender on me, even though I'm totally okay with being this. I don't like all the words attached to it and the constructs around it. So it's like a horseshoe, you know, one end could be non-binary. And one could be completely celebrating whatever this is. And someone would from the outside and say, well, she's a woman. I don't have to go around doing that. I can just be what this experience is without the extra thing, right? It's a turkey or it's a scrub day. And I don't like it or I do like it. You with me? So when everyone says should, they're creating a self. They're saying it about you. You should do this. They're creating imposition of the self really has nothing to do with you, by the way, so don't take it personally. It's about them. Everything that everyone is saying you should do is about them. And I think you could be just honest with yourself about what is my experience. Well, if you're in a female body, you're going to have female body type experiences, because those are the parts that the lunch lady gave you. Oh, that sounds bad. Oh, I just saw like a uterus land on my cafeteria tray. Don't go there. I'm going to have to get that out of my head first. You get it. Tell the truth. This is my experience. And it's different tomorrow. It's okay. And you might feel like, yeah, I'm non-binary tomorrow. Whatever. It's not the important thing. The important thing is telling yourself the truth about what is actually happening. Not the overlay. Now, I want to go on record as saying that does not mean you should be disrespectful of people who identify a particular way, because that's what they're doing and that's what their reality is, and it's not good or bad, and it's not for you to say it's good or bad. But you have to be honest with this one. That's the only person that you can be close up and intimate with, really. You have to take care of this changing, impermanent, dynamically related self. And my own feeling is that when someone comes up and says, you shouldn't do that, or you should do that, for me, it's always the right response. What do you have to lose by being happy? I don't have anything to lose. It makes me closer. It brings me closer to this. I think we really do have to. We'll be together, don't worry.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.